I'm Dana Lloyd. Welcome to Soul Sister Conversations, the podcast, where you will be inspired and empowered to connect more deeply with your authentic self as we explore topics of personal development, leadership, and spirituality. Your journey to your most authentic self starts right now. James Mullinger was one of the hardest working comedians in the UK and the comedy editor for GQ magazine when he moved to a small town on the east coast of Canada 8 years ago. Since his arrival, he has taken the country by storm. Sold out shows across the country, appearances on CBC's The Debaters, movies, TV shows, festivals, awards, and stand-up specials. James Mullinger is one of the hardest working people I know. Now he can add new Canadian and new author to his growing list of accomplishments. Brit Happens, the title of his book, is a perfect vacation read. Authentic, vulnerable, and funny. Oh, so funny. I was excited to dive into this conversation to talk about his new book. I love his positive outlook and the lessons on life James drops throughout this episode. What an inspirational chat. James Mullinger, welcome to Soul Sister Conversations.
Hi, Dana. How's it going?
It's going awesome, and I'm delighted to have a conversation with you. But first off, I think there's like a huge round of congratulations for you. First off, congratulations on becoming a Canadian. That's pretty awesome. As we're approaching Canada Day.
That's very exciting. Yeah, my first Canada Day as a Canadian. So, yes.
That's awesome. And congrats on both writing the book and making the national bestseller list.
Well, thank you very much. I think it was just local bestseller list, I wouldn't want to take credit for anything that wasn't, but I think it was something like best-selling book by an English comedian who moved to New Brunswick, Rosse Road on the 14th of February, 2014, something like that. But whatever it was that they awarded with me or said that I had achieved, I am very grateful to all the people who kindly picked up the book.
Yeah, well, it's called Brit Happens. Yeah. And I can honestly, truly say, you know, I highly recommend the book to people. I love funny, humorous reads. And I find humorous reads a little hard to come by. You know, sometimes there's a promise of funny and then you're like, not so much. But your book is a wonderful mix of honesty, vulnerability, and humor. And there were so many times I dropped the book to my lap and I was just laughing out loud and going, that is so true. Or, you know, you just hit it right. Or just your vulnerability and be willing to laugh at yourself was refreshing.
Oh, that's really, really kind of you to say, and it means the world to me, because I mean, as you know, it's such a solitary thing, you know, writing a book, and of course then incredibly nerve-wracking when it's coming out. And I think it's nerve-wracking anyway, but as you know from your book, you know, when you are being so open, it kind of makes you kind of feel even more vulnerable and kind of susceptible to criticism, because you are kind of opening yourself up. So, you know, you kind of think, wow, you know, if someone doesn't like this, then they basically are saying they hate me.
Right. And we'll start there, because you talk so often, you know, in the early part of your life as being bullied as a child. And anytime I finish a book, especially someone I'm going to interview, I sit back and I think, like, what were my takeaways? And that was a theme, you know, early on. And some, you can still feel it as you're telling stories as your older self. But, you know, for anyone who felt, you know, they were bullied or were told they were no good in some way, or felt they were an insider or struggles with self-acceptance, you know, I think people will love this very relatable story. And you're often telling very personal, serious stories about your life, but you still manage to make us laugh as you take us through them. And I'm curious, was writing this book healing for you?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I definitely found it extremely cathartic, especially obviously writing it during COVID. I mean, it was conceived before COVID and it was commissioned pre-COVID, but most of, you know, I can honestly say I don't know if it would be finished by now if it weren't for COVID. So, you know, it was kind of, you know, certainly being taken off the road and being at home meant it got finished quicker. And it was quite strange, because I've always written a diary. And so as a child, when I had struggles, well, throughout my life, when I've had struggles, I've used writing as an outlet. So I feel like writing the book somewhat came natural. But what was interesting was suddenly when I saw it kind of designed in PDF format with page numbers, I suddenly felt absolutely petrified, because I'd kind of almost forgotten that other people were going to read this. And it was this, you know, this moment of, wow, I've really put it all out there. And I, there was very briefly a temptation to possibly tone it down, trim it back. But in the end, I decided, because I mean, all of the things, as with my stand-up, where I'm the butt of all of my jokes in stand-up, all of the personal things and the, you know, disturbing things that I've kind of talked about and shared in the book are about myself. And I kind of thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I very much doubt I'm ever going to get a chance to write a second memoir. So I really should make it honest. And I think for the points that you made, that really for other people who are struggling in some ways, to be able to see that, you know, that things can change and things can be different. And I think certainly when I look back to you know, being bullied as a child, and I obviously talk a lot about that in this, I felt that it was important to include that, because obviously with a memoir, there's a lot happens in everyone's life. So an important thing was to kind of, the, you know, the Goosley and the publisher, who were amazing, and the editor, James Langer, who's an incredible award-winning poet as well. So, you know, they were both very helpful in basically saying to me, you know, on what to focus on. And really what we decided was, we wanted the book to be about a love letter. We wanted it to be a love letter to Atlantic Canada. So really anything I've included about other parts of my life and before I came to Atlantic Canada was very much focused on what are the things that happened to me that made me fall in love with this place. And really the accepting nature of people here and the kindness of people here and the way in which people look out for you are things that made me fall in love with this place so fully and quickly and just, you know, so all-encompassing that all of the things that I'd struggled with before. And then equally, because of that kind of theme of bullying, that's why it was important for me to kind of include, you know, for example, a lot of people wouldn't expect a comedian's memoir, or indeed a comic book, and essentially what is supposed to be a book to make people laugh. They possibly wouldn't expect a very detailed chapter on domestic violence. But again, my feelings about that are also so intrinsically linked to my loathing and hatred of bullies, and that is whether they be playground bullies, bullies in the home, bullies on social media, and even bullies on stage, comedians who are choosing to bully people, all of those things. So I think for that reason, and to answer your question, I go off on a lot of tangents, as you can tell. I mean, the editing process of the book was interesting, because I'm very long-winded, and of course the aim of the book was to have very pithy short chapters. And I think it's because my discipline on stage is so, you know, kind of finite. We're on stage, I'm right. Kind of, you know, trying to pare everything back. How do I get to the laugh quicker? That that in conversation, especially when I'm chatting with a friend like this, I'm slightly more long-winded. But I guess ultimately, having done so many kind of fundraiser gigs where I would be up on stage talking about something very serious, like whether it be domestic violence or suicide prevention, or whatever charity that I've been doing the show for, and then being able to segue from a very moving, emotional and disturbing speech into stand-up, it that gave me more realization that could also work in literary form, where you can have a chapter that is for want of a better phrase, a silly, frivolous, funny chapter about, you know, Maritime is talking about where things used to be or whatever it is, but then also have a serious chapter about bullying or domestic violence or something else. So it's really, really nice to hear that that you enjoyed that aspect.
Yeah. And when you say it was a love letter to Atlantic Canada, I can really say it almost feels like a love letter to anybody who has dreams, anybody who is trying to overcome. I mean, you really are inspirational. And, you know, I'm always fascinated by the fact that you go into stand-up comedy after you've experienced bullying. And I would think that would be a hard industry to be in, where you said you can get bullied on stage. It almost feels like you could do deja vu, where you could take an emotional beating. So I'm curious, what was your draw ultimately into being a stand-up comic?
Excellent question. Yes. I mean, I think for my mind, it was a fascination with the process, the art form, but also the people doing it. And again, as a teenager, I didn't have many friends. I definitely struggled in school. I was failing everything. I wasn't athletic. I was what my mum recently jokingly described as a triple bill of failure for them. Because, you know, traditionally, like if your child isn't academic, maybe they're athletic. And if they're neither, maybe they're popular and they have a great time. Whereas I really had none of it going on. And the thing that I, you know, spent my time with was sitting at home watching comedy videos. And one of my earliest memories is seeing my parents, who were not that they were necessarily overly strict people, but I never really saw them lose control until one day we were watching a John Candy movie on video, and seeing them kind of lose control, hysterically laughing, I became fascinated with this man, but equally this art form. I'm like, who is this amazing man? Where is he from? How does he do this incredible thing where he reduces two people who are kind of fairly stiff upper lip, don't tend to lose control? How does he make them lose control? And I became fascinated with, of course, so A, John Candy, B, the art forms. It was also my first realization that there was this magical place called Canada where it creates these extremely funny people. And then I started, in addition to watching comedy and watching stand-up comedy and then reading comedians' autobiographies, I was really confused by the dichotomy of the fact that these comedians did this, what I thought was this incredible job and made people laugh and walked out on stage in front of thousands of people. But equally, when I read their books, they seemed to be oddballs like me, and they seemed to have all the same kind of insecurities and all of the same, you know, paranoia and all of the same fears and everything. And so I couldn't understand how those two things. So that fascination, I think, is what really got me into it. And then doing it, I mean, I kind of feel like not that I ever want to give you know, bullies or anyone that kind of makes anyone suffer any credit. But I mean, I suppose some of what I went through as a child definitely made doing the job easier, because I mean, you know, walking into a classroom when you've just been humiliated, whether it be, you know, put in the garbage can and thrown down some stairs, or thrown in a bath of cold urine, or whatever the thing is, walking into a room full of kids pointing and laughing at you, as opposed to obviously with you, there's nothing ever as bad as that feeling. So really, being on stage and telling some jokes and people not laughing is really not that bad after all of that. So yeah, it was kind of in some ways, I think preparation, a good preparation.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You tell one of the stories about one of your bullies approaches you after a show and actually wants you to go out for a drink. And I was wondering, did you?
Yes. Sorry. Yes. And you're right. It's funny. I was reading that extract at a book reading on Saturday night. I realized I didn't really explain that fully, but yes, I did. And I think I was one of those people that for many years, kind of like I mentioned my godfather in the book, who had a similar experience at school and who has found it very hard to kind of get past it. And for many years, I definitely harbored kind of very angry, bitter, you know, thoughts and in some ways, you know, vengeful thoughts about them. But yes, I mean, so when I was approached, I did go for the drink, and that was kind of how the conversation played out, where he had kind of no idea what he was doing, or so he said. I mean, this is always the excuse given out. And it obviously, as we know, I mean, sometimes, you know, people who behave like that in schools or indeed in any environment are struggling with their own issues. None of that, of course, makes it acceptable. But yes, I did. And it was, in some ways, cathartic. It definitely exercised the demon. I mean, to be honest, the thing that really exercised the demon wasn't so much having the drink. What exercised it, I think, was, you know, this person who had picked on me for everything you could possibly imagine, seeing them, you know, sitting in a room full of, you know, it was the largest club, you know, but maybe kind of, you know, 450 people who'd all kind of come to see me. They're all there laughing. To see them in this audience laughing, I guess that was the thing that kind of really exercised any demons or you know, bad memories, was suddenly they're all laughing with me rather than at me. And I guess that was definitely a turning point.
Would you say, what have you learned about forgiveness? Or was it a matter of going out for a drink and it's kind of like, I have arrived, like, look at me now? Or do you forgive him? Or do you think in those kinds of terms?
Yes, that's a really, really good point in terms of the difference between the two. I mean, I definitely never in my life think in terms of, you know, I've arrived kind of way, and I've never, I never have that kind of thing. And I always think that someone once said to me, and I always think this is the, I never agree with this kind of thinking of where people, someone once used the phrase, they said that, success is the best revenge. And I always think, that's such a negative way of looking at things. And also, what is success really? Success is, mm-hmm. is being happy and at peace. It's not, bums on seats in a venue or dollars in the bank. But yes, to the point, it's definitely 100%. It's about forgiveness and being at peace with things. And that's something that's definitely taken me kind of years to learn. But I certainly feel like now I'm at a point in my life where, even now when, people are mean or critical or whatever else, like I'm kind of able to be completely at peace and say, I know what my priorities are in life. My priorities are my friends and my family. And it's wherever possible, bringing happiness and to people around me. Then that, and I include people, that's people I know and people I don't know. And just kind of, being as kind as possible as you can all the time. And when people aren't that and choose to live their lives not like that, I think it's a shame, but I don't dwell on it. I just try and be as nice as I can be.
What has been, your biggest learning lessons, or how did you, in terms of moving to a place of peace, because that is a choice to move there. And you're referring to your godfather, which I assume is like the buddy that went to school with your dad. Yes. And you talk in the book very much about how they had two different outlooks, where they had similar sort of not maybe great experiences, but your father talked about them, in a much more positive light versus your godfather, just had a much more difficult time. And I felt like that was a real, they taught you about outlook when you saw these two very opposing views. And I'm curious, did that play into it, or what helps you move to peace?
Good question. Yes, I think possibly that realization that we can focus on the negatives. And I guess it's a tricky one, because obviously, the world is in a terrible state right now. Mm-hmm. And that's, so I'm certainly not saying that we want to ignore those things. And of course, all of us want to help in any way we can change things. And there's many reasons to not be positive. But I think, yes, certainly in day-to-day life, it's definitely not wanting to dwell on. And of course, the other thing is all of the problems that any problems I may have or most of us have are highly kind of small and insignificant, certainly compared to all the terrible things that are happening in the world and what so many people are going through. So, but yes, definitely, I think in terms of perception, and what we dwell on, I think that is really everything. And I guess an example of it being is the past 2 years, where I look back at, there's been so many awful things about the pandemic. We've all lost people. We've all missed things. We've all kind of suffered in so many different ways. I've lost friends and family members, and of course, we all have. And one of the narratives, of course, about the past kind of 2.5 years has been, how hard it has been on children, which is absolutely not to be, disputed. And I don't disagree with that. But one of the things that I've seen and that I choose to focus on, which I guess this is an example of me taking my dad's line of thinking in life, and rather than kind of looking back on his school days as this terrible time, as his best friend does, and him looking back on all the fun times, the way that I kind of have, one of the things that I kind of noticed recently was, our generations, and by that I mean I kind of anyone kind of that is either Gen X or millennials or boomers, like we are kind of famously like the three most depressed generations in history. Like we're the ones that spend the most on therapy, the most on self-help. And really, like, this is because we've always kind of been waiting for the next big thing. We've kind of been trained and taught to kind of want and expect more and strive for more, and as a result, we always kind of lived our lives going, well, I'll be happy when I get the pay rise. I'll be happy when I get a promotion. I'll be happy when my holiday comes. I'll be happy at Christmas. I'll be happy this weekend. Like, we were never just living. And really, every single self-help book, from Tony Robbins to The Subtle Art, or every single, most of them boil down to essentially the same kind of core principle of, you know, live for the journey, not the destination. And that obviously doesn't mean, you know, live for the moment in an irresponsible way, but enjoy now rather than constantly. And really one thing that Generation Alpha, our children's generation, have learned over the past 2 years is kind of not to look forward to anything, because if you do, it's just going to get cancelled. So as a result, like, I mean, my 8-year-old River, like, he has this whole different outlook, because for the past 2 years, like, but before the pandemic, he was constantly like, when's the weekend, and when's Halloween, and when's Valentine's Day, when I get all my chocolates, and when's Christmas, when's my birthday? But then suddenly, for the past 2 years, he stopped looking forward to Halloween, Thanksgiving, whatever it was, because the premiere was just going to cancel it. So, and as kind of sad as it is, what it created was an outlook in him where he now doesn't ever really look forward to anything other than the moment. And he wakes up in the morning and says, what is in front of me now that is awesome that we can do? Dad, let's go and play soccer. Let's go for a bike ride. And as a result, I believe, and this is kind of my dad's outlook playing into this, I have this belief that Generation Alpha are going to be the happiest, least depressed generation in history, because they're the first generation ever that are literally waking up and going, what is beautiful and brilliant today that I can enjoy?
That's fantastic. Great outlook. I mean, that's what it is. It's all about the choice. So yes. If there's one good thing that came out of the pandemic, I mean, that's an awesome one.
Yes.
That your son has learned well, because it could go the other way. So to choose the moment,
yes.
You know, as you say about our slogan in New Brunswick, be in this place, just be. Maybe we should put on our sign.
Yes, I agree. That's exactly it. And if we're going to have that outlook, this is the place to do it.
That's so true. I want to back up just for a minute when you were talking about your parents and how you jokingly said that you were triple bill of failure, but so typical of places where children can find success is in athletics and academia and so on. And for those kids that, if you're not good at that, where do you fit in this world? And I think you're a great example of, you don't have to be the same as everyone else to make it. You can do your own thing. And you talk in the book about those early years of, like you said, spoke just earlier about John Candy. We have another thing in common. I loved John Candy. He was fantastic. And I would try to watch, you know, every movie that he was in. He was so funny. But you talk about listening to Steve Martin and Whoopi Goldberg and Richard Pryor. Did what part did visualization play in your growing up? Did you visualize yourself being on stage? Did you visualize yourself trying to be funny and entertaining people in that way?
Yes. So I really did, even though I visualized it, but I didn't ever think that I could or would do it. I mean, I was, you know, kind of sitting there kind of definitely picturing myself walking on that stage. And what allowed me to kind of think that was reading interviews with them and reading their memoirs and realizing that they too struggled with all of these anxieties and insecurities. And that they were doing it. So that kind of helped me visualize it, but I never thought I could do it. Like, I was literally, I was totally scared to walk up to another kid in my class or walk up to a neighbor or kids playing ball on my street. I wouldn't dare go out and speak to them. So the thought of walking out on a stage and doing it was completely unthinkable. And it was a teacher that first told me that this could be possible and it could be something that I could do. And it was, and I mean, there's many reasons why I think I felt I could open up to her. She was an amazing woman by the name of Mrs. Murphy. And she was my English teacher. And she was diagnosed with lung cancer and told that she obviously was going to not be teaching us anymore. And she said, no, absolutely not. I want to continue teaching them even from home, from my bed. So we would walk to her house from the school and she would teach us from her bed. And it was just this incredible thing, which at the time, obviously, I mean, as a teenager, you obviously appreciate, but now looking back, I just cannot imagine someone choosing to spend their kind of final weeks, you know, finishing their job. And I mean, obviously we're all kind of told that, you know, that we should focus less on our work, but this was obviously someone who's, you know, educating children and being there for children was her life. And so it wasn't simply a job to her. And she taught us everything that we needed to know from the syllabus. But she was also very obsessed with feminist readings of classic novels, which is why I chose to study English literature and women's studies at university, because in kind of in honor of her. But but one of the things that she did was she sat down with us all individually and asked us about our dreams. And I think possibly because sounds awful to say, and I'm just being honest, I think possibly maybe because of her condition, it was one of the reasons I felt safe to open up to her, because I'd never told anyone about this dream before that I wanted to perform and be on stage, because people would just, I mean, literally laugh at me, but for the wrong reasons. And I remember vividly sitting there, and she was holding my hand at the time. I remember saying this to her, that I wanted to do this thing. And she was the first person to kind of give me any belief that, A, she said, you know, that you can do this. And it was her that first coined the phrase, which as you know, I mean, I've used many times in stand-up and in keynotes, but that phrase, anything is possible, which, and I mention this story sometimes in keynotes, because I feel like often we are afraid in life to spout what seem like cliches, or, you know, is it greeting card light? Is it like a t-shirt slogan? The phrase anything is possible is, I've joyfully seen it on the walls of almost every school in New Brunswick that I visited, and as it should be. But I feel like in life sometimes we're afraid of cliches, and cliches or well-worn phrases are well-worn for a reason. I mean, it's like our favorite t-shirts are well-worn because they're amazing and we love them and they make us feel comforted. So a well-worn phrase should never be afraid to be used. And of course, I mean, for me as a very depressed teenager with nothing going for him, that phrase, anything is possible, was life-changing. And granted, it still took me, you know, 20 years and a visit to New Brunswick to make me eventually do stand up. It was her saying that made me really start to think seriously about it. And again, I had kind of 20 years to really plot it and plan it before I eventually did it.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's amazing when you have teachers like that that change your life.
Yes.
And I'll just sort of mention as a side note for anybody listening, for if the reason why you should buy the book, if any, is the story that you tell of who you call Mr. Buzzkill, your Latin teacher, who goes around the classroom and asks everybody what their dreams are. And you say your dream is to meet Paul McCartney and tell him how happy he makes you. And the dream squasher teacher says, you'll never meet Paul McCartney. Yes. And then you go on to tell the story, and I won't ruin it for any but the readers, but you need to buy it, the book, just for that story alone. I was enraptured. It contains all sorts of things. It feels like it's law of attraction and visualization and hilarity. I mean, it's incredible. So you've had some incredible experiences in your life. And I mean, I was like, dying laughing reading that, and also going, I cannot believe this. Like, he actually got to meet Paul McCartney, but how you got to meet him. So I'm curious, do you believe in law of attraction or this idea of visualization? Because it's not only that story, you talk about meeting Jerry Seinfeld, who is a hero of yours. Do you put it out there and believe that the universe is conspiring to assist you in some way? Do you think of your connection to the greater world around you?
Yes, I think I do. I mean, I believe, and I guess it sounds twee to say it, and it's often sounds possibly unfair to say it. Like, I always think that when I was growing up, I always found it quite frustrating when I would read, genuinely successful people, and like myself, who's just kind of able to, you know, fortunate enough and feel very fortunate to do what I do. But like, I would read like famous people saying in interviews, you know, that, you know, it just takes hard work and belief and you can do it. And you kind of think, well, it's easy for you to say it happened for you, but are you suggesting that it didn't happen for everyone else because they just didn't work hard enough? And those are things that I'm always kind of very aware of. But I mean, I certainly feel like, for example, in the case of like stand-up comedy, I believe anyone can do stand-up comedy. I mean, it's literally just, it is putting in the hours. It is exactly the same as any other, not just art form, but any other anything. I mean, for example, I cannot imagine being a mechanic. I mean, that to me seems like the hardest job in the world. I don't understand anything about cars, the intricacies of cars. I cannot, but I mean, as I understand it, if you are willing to put in the hours and work, study for 4 or 5 years, you, in theory, anyone can. I mean, I still can't imagine myself being able to, but But apparently, if you put in the hours for 3, 4, 5 years, you can master it. Similarly with stand-up, I mean, you know, there's often a misguided belief that people have, which is that the stand-up comedians are the class clown. But I've found that to be completely the opposite. There's maybe a handful that have been, but mostly people that become comedians are people who are kind of often the outsider, kind of looking in, and you know, not the person that is sat there at the pub table. And often the person who is hilarious at the pub table does not make the best comedian. But I mean, it is such a completely different art form, essentially. It's a different discipline. But all of that said, I mean, I certainly do believe that a lot of the things that I guess the thing that I would say is that none of what I do, like, essentially all my dreams came true, in that everything I've ever wanted to do, when I read diary entries from when I was a teenager, I mean, all I've ever wanted to do is to, perform comedy, write. I wanted to work for a magazine. I mean, all of these things. And I guess the thing is that no one has ever given me permission to do any of the things that I have done or still do. And I've made it all happen myself. And I guess what I mean by that is that some people get a lucky break where they are signed by an agent who then, makes all these calls and makes these things happen. Like that hasn't happened for me. I mean, I have agents who are wonderful. And, all of the things that I do day to day are things that I have, when I went to do an internship at GQ, it was a 1 week internship, and I made sure that in that 1 week that they couldn't do without me. So they would have to keep me for a second week. And that second week became 14 years. Similarly starting the magazine. I mean, when we launched that, it wasn't like we didn't have investors. We didn't have funding. We didn't have government behind us. We literally sat in house and said, we want to start a magazine about Atlantic Canada from our home. No one gave us permission to do it. No one asked us to do it. And we just did it. And then, I mean, similarly with my stand-up, I mean, my whole life is kind of like the way that some performers, when they do a fringe festival, they spend that week flyering and pushing and promoting just to fill those shows. And I've obviously done those fringes, and it's kind of how I learned that thing. But what I realized was I needed to make my entire life a fringe festival, especially if I'm going to try and do stand-up in a place that doesn't have a built-in industry. So I think that's really the key is, for example, I hear this a lot. Like, I often get asked by people starting out, or indeed, struggling in the early years of a particular creative outlet, when they say, well, how about this? Or how did you get this? One phrase I hear quite a lot is they say, well, I wrote to so-and-so and I never heard back. The other thing I hear from comedians a lot is, so-and-so's never booked me. Or they say it to me. They say, oh, you've never booked me. And I say, you've never written to me. You've never asked. And there's this misnomer of I don't know where it comes from, but this idea that you can just decide that you're going to start stand-up comedy or writing or whatever it is, and then everyone's going to come to you. And I mean, granted, when I started doing stand-up in 2005, I did have you all kind of have that arrogant idea of like, the whole world has been waiting for me to start. But now, having been doing it almost 20 years, I can say not only is no one waiting, not only was no one waiting for me to start, no one's kind of waiting for me now. It's everything I send that, and so when I hear people say that their phone hasn't rung or no one's emailed them, I mean, I would say I probably send upwards of 100 emails a day, and probably 2 at best of those 100 emails become anything. And anytime someone says, oh, how did you get booked by so-and-so, whether it be, for example, the Debaters, I by emailing them 1,000 times and pitching 1,000 ideas and keep going until something lands. So I think that's really the answer, which is not asking permission. I mean, obviously tenacity. The grind literally never stops. There is never, I have never once felt like I'm on a roll. Actually, when I say that, there was one period when I thought I was on a roll. Where I was like, my diary was filling up. I was starting to sell big-ish theaters in places outside New Brunswick, like 800 seater theaters in like Toronto and Halifax. And I was getting kind of flown to, Toronto for auditions, and I thought that this is it. And that time was February 2020.
And then the universe said, we're going to put a stop to that.
Exactly. And I'm glad it did, because I was getting, I wouldn't say I was getting complacent, but I very briefly thought, I thought to myself, now I'm on a roll. And you know what? I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, it does happen in gigs sometimes when you're up on stage. But generally, yeah, when you're up on stage and you think, I'm on a roll now, I can say anything and they'll laugh. That's when it starts to go downhill. You've got to constantly be spinning all the plates. And the second that you think I've got this made, the universe will tell you that you haven't.
I love that you spoke to the grind and what actually happens behind the scenes, because you're right. I think when we see someone who's successful and doing the thing that they love, that somehow there is an easy path. And the other thing I see you as is a father, a hard worker who adores comedy, media, and the arts, who's just trying to provide for his family doing what he loves. You know, this is your job, this is your career. And that, for me, that even came through in the book, and you said, this is work. Because although anybody can do this, if you don't take it seriously, it can't become the thing that you want it to become. And one of the shows I love watching is Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Mm-hmm. The interview between him and Steve Harvey is so hilarious. And Steve Harvey, of course, is very funny. Yeah. And he said, all the comedians that I know who smoke weed are broke. And I think he was, you know, he was really saying, because Jerry was talking about how he writes a joke a day, or he writes every day. Yeah. This is developing a repertoire. It's really committing to craft, committing to yourself. And I think you just spoke to that so beautifully, that there is a grind to it, that you have to make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a funny one, because it's a job where, you know, a lot of hard jobs, you don't have to pretend that they look easy. Whereas with stand up, you know, you're walking out on stage, and of course, backstage, you're fretting, you're sweating, you're pacing. And in my case, like, I mean, my OCD, you know, fiddling is like in overdrive. And I kind of have to warn people sometimes that, just so you know, because I have like nervous tics and facial tics, like that I kind of do like 90 minutes worth of them in 2 minutes before I walk out on stage. So don't think I'm having a seizure, because you're going to see some serious like face twitching right before I walk out. And of course, when you walk out, you're looking as calm and confident as you possibly can, and you're obviously, you know, looking like you're making all this up on the spot. So it's an interesting kind of dichotomy that there is these two things going on at the same time, where you're trying to look calm, act calm, and yet there's so much going on behind the scenes. One bit, again, this idea that comedians perpetuated this myth themselves, that, you know, hey, I only work 40 minutes a night or an hour a night. And I mean, the reality is, I mean, as a comedian, I spend way more time at a desk doing admin than I ever did when I had an office job. And there's so much more, but to your point about and then the taking it seriously side. I mean, there's something. I think I was someone that for many years when I first started out, not that I felt like I was irresponsible, but I definitely enjoyed quite a kind of a party spirit with the job. And I mean, to give an example of kind of how much it is, like, I have a very strict, like, I will not drink alcohol before or during a show now. And that was something that I used to do, not all the time, like, I would never do it at corporate gigs, but certainly at club gigs, I would see nothing wrong with. And just to be clear, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with comedians that do this. But I had a realization that I am at my absolute best, which sounds weird to say, yeah, someone does their job better, not on alcohol. I mean, it doesn't
shocking.
It's shocking. Who would have thought? And it's funny. I mean, Jimmy Carr did say this to me years and years ago. He said, he said he's never understood the idea that people have when they, especially especially non-professional speakers, like people, when people are doing a wedding speech and they say, I've got a drink to take the edge off. And it's like, literally, when does alcohol ever really like make someone do better at the thing they're about to do? It doesn't really. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had this realization. And again, I mean, that said, there are lots of people. And again, I could certainly do the job on it, but I definitely realized, and I did a show, one of my first shows after I gave up was about gave up drinking at shows was maybe 4 years ago. And it was at the Playhouse in Chester. And a friend of mine, Bill Bean, who was at the head at the time, the head of the QE2 Foundation, he had seen me probably more times than almost anyone else. We had met in a Yuck Yucks, Halifax. It's, you know, how you make friends in the Maritimes. You meet someone, they come to a show, you become friends. And I actually was just with him this weekend as well. And he'd probably seen me perform maybe a dozen times. And the show did go better than normal. Like it was a lovely show, and part of that was thanks to the theatre and the amazing being inside this kind of gorgeous theatre. It was just the perfect size, perfect sound. But it did go it better than normal. And after the show, he said, "I don't know what it is." He said something was different, and I said, "Well, funny enough, I could be this. I've stopped drinking before or during shows." And he was like, "Well, that must be it." Like it was just, I think. I guess it's little things like you can go out and do the show as it's planned, of course, having had a beer or two or a glass of wine or two. But having you need to be your brain needs to be the sharpest it can possibly be. So, you know, being on stage, what really improved, I think, at that point, the main difference was me being able to kind of do a lot more crowd work, a lot more spinning plates with the crowd, talk to one person, bring it back, loop it back. And it gave me, you know, a lot more freedom. So I guess kind of like operating heavy machinery, you know, it's best done with a very, very clear head.
Yeah, that's interesting. And one of the things that you talk about in your book a lot, you know, what are your different kinds of gigs, and you'll talk about have a good gig and a bad gig, and then, you know, some will go horribly wrong, some will go fantastic. And I like on page 77, you talk about that moment that you performed in Sussex when you shifted your material, you know, trying to find, you know, your thing. And to me, I kind of chalk it up to this authenticity and you know, you start talking about you'd never done it before, simply talking about my life in St. John. You say things you'd seen and heard, complaints from locals. And you made jokes about lining up all the broken ferries instead of building a bridge. And you said the audience went wild with laughter, and you left the stage that night soaked in sweat and dripping in joy. And I'm curious about what you have learned about authenticity, bringing authenticity into your life, because that seemed to have has really worked for you. What do you say about that in talking about your life? Has that worked the best for you?
Yes, it's a really, really abusively put. I think so. I mean, it certainly worked by being I think this, and this is possibly something I've literally only just learned in the last few weeks, to be honest. This is really, really, and again, I mean, it's a beautiful, and again, I, as you know, I absolutely adored your podcast with Nancy Regan, and I just thought it was amazing to hear both of you, two of the smartest people I know and most inspiring people I know. So it was really beautiful to hear the two of you talk about things like this. And I think for me, definitely, and again, and also I will say that that podcast, and if anyone's listening, I'm sure everyone listening has already heard it, but if you haven't, please stop listening to this one and go and listen to Dana and Nancy, because it really is.
Thank you for that.
But yeah. I mean, again, I wouldn't overuse this phrase. It's one of those life-changing lessons. So, I really wouldn't, I wouldn't give such high praise if it weren't true. And I really mean it was so powerful and so inspiring. But I think that kind of, that is something I would say I've learned just in the past few weeks by doing, because I was worried about the book coming out with having all of this truth and authentic self and being so open. I was so worried about it coming out, mainly because I kind of thought, well, what if people who like my comedy then go, oh my God, he's really depressing or boring, or and I think possibly by doing shows during the pandemic, doing virtual gigs where the audience is obviously muted, but I can see them. And so throughout the past years, I've done upwards of 70, 80 virtual comedy gigs. I have one tomorrow. I mean, and they have continued because it's now become just a separate.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really one of the few benefits to come out of this. Virtual gigs began as a compromise, as a replacement for in person, but it's subsequently become something which organizations do to bring together, you know, for example, I've been doing a lot of them for RBC, where they were, like, last week was their staff appreciation week. So I performed for every single bank teller and everyone that works for RBC Atlantic Canada. Again, that was never going to be an in-person event, because as soon as the show ended, they all needed to open the branches. But I got to perform for, 2,000 people. And wow. Yeah, it was just a lovely, and it's been a really magical thing. And one of the things I've learned doing those shows is I will occasionally stop the kind of the fast-paced gags and tell a very possibly moving or very honest, authentic story. And that is something which I don't think I would ever have done in stand-up, because in stand-up you kind of walk on stage and you're like, right, I need the whole room to be in hysterical laughter every 30 seconds for 90 minutes, otherwise I've failed. And if there's a protracted silence in the room, you would be terrified of that. You're kind of trained to be terrified of that. And yet, because these kind of rather honest stories were being so well received on these virtual gigs, and people saying, like, I, laughed and cried, I have started incorporating them into stand-up as well. And in the past couple of months, I've been doing that. I did it at the Playhouse in Fredericton to 700 people, did it to Imperial Theatre in St. John, where I will, that has definitely given me, I think it's literally just something I've just learned about being vulnerable, being authentic, opening up, and just being honest with the audience and letting people, and now realizing that actually, yeah, I mean, and I guess from a, and that is all done with the utmost sincerity and honesty. But from a professional standpoint, or from an entertainment standpoint, one of the takeaways I've had is that, really, I guess this is what people have said to me, and someone specifically wrote this to me after the Fredericton Playhouse show, when they said it was kind of like, going to see a movie of, like, having this roller coaster of emotions. And really, if you are going out to see a show, and I take such responsibility for the fact that people, it's hard to get out of the house. It's hard to find babysitters. It's hard to, it's expensive. So I feel such a responsibility to the audience, which is again, part another reason why I think, I realized that, everyone deserves 100% when you walk out on stage every night. But the thing that people say is yes, that it's, kind of, it's an all-encompassing. I want to give an experience. And so, yes, I know I can make people laugh for 90 minutes, but if I can make them cry or feel inspired or uplifted as well, then from a professional standpoint, that can only be a good thing.
It's so true, because I saw a show that you gave at the Kingston Peninsula at Dunham's Run last year, and you did that at the end of the show, and I think maybe it was partly from us all coming out of the pandemic. We needed that connection, and going to see you when you share some of these emotional stories of things that have happened, or to some of your customers, people who come to see you. I think that particular one was a lady whose daughter might have passed from cancer or something. Yeah. And you had, a chat with her. And I think people are connected to you in that way, because coming out to see you is making you feel good. You're giving us an experience. It's beyond what a standard comic would give us. So thank you for giving us that. And I think you're finding out what works. The fact that you're even just starting to see that open up how authenticity and vulnerability on stage can work is kind of incredible.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you for saying that. And it's always a joy to see you there. Some of my favorite pictures of you and I together were taken years ago. Yeah. And actually was that particular night, wasn't it, that I met Linda's daughter
Yes, that's right. That's
yeah, it was. Yeah. It was and yeah, and it's. I mean, I think part of it is that over the years, I mean, it's a uniquely beautiful thing to be able to say that when I walk out on stage in New Brunswick, generally I know half the audience, either through a personal friendship like you and I, or through Facebook, where I've seen their pictures and have followed them, but I don't necessarily know them, or I've seen them around. And so it's kind of such a I think that now being able to tell those stories, and because really it is a gathering of friends, and that's kind of how I try and look at I kind of try and look at stand-up shows anywhere like that, but especially in New Brunswick, where we are all coming together. And also there's the fact that, I mean, I'm so grateful to the fact that people especially within New Brunswick will come and see me in some cases a couple of times a year. So A, I want each show to be as unique as possible. There's always going to be material that I've kind of honed and workshopped to get just right, but every show I want to come up with something new. And then again, also, you know, in many cases, pay tribute to people that are in the audience and people that have come out, and yeah, give us all a connection where maybe, and again, I mean, I know from that night, the amount of people that went up to Linda afterwards and spoke to her, it was really, really quite beautiful to see and sharing their own experiences. And really that's what, you know, I think that's what comedy should and can be. And I think, you know, because I grew up seeing it bring a family together, I think it's a lovely thing to see it bring community together as well.
I'm curious, when you play outside of New Brunswick, you tell a lot of the jokes that we can relate to here in New Brunswick. What do you talk about in your stand-up? Do you talk about New Brunswick, or do you have a different set if you were doing something in British Columbia or Ontario?
Yes, I think generally, well, it does vary. So quite often, for example, I mean, certainly when I go back to the UK, when I do shows in the UK or in the States, I essentially pivot the material about here to living in or moving to or growing up in a small town. So, for example, I mean, even in the States, I can, you know, the directions thing can kind of work about any small town. So, of course, it's ideal if I'm performing it in a place that's near to a small town. And I mean, a lot of the kind of university level research that I do before gigs is working out equivalents of things. And of course, I mean, a lot of my act, and I mean, a lot of my act, obviously, well, my entire act before I moved to Canada was obviously about, you know, whatever was going on in my life at that particular time. I guess, so all of the kind of relationship and parenting stuff that I do about here obviously applies anywhere. I can obviously switch material up. However, one of the things that I have to say about performing in Toronto or anywhere in Ontario or BC or indeed anywhere in the rest of Canada is one of the only reasons I'm able to tour is because of the kindness of Maritimers spreading the word. And so quite literally, like the only reason I have a following in BC, for instance, is that the first time I played there and I posted I'm playing in Kelowna or Vernon or Penticton, wherever it was, and I posted I'm doing a show here, there was like 100 comments underneath of people, mainly in New Brunswick, but possibly across the Maritimes too, tagging their friends going, hey, you've got to go and see this guy. He's one of ours. He's one of us. and so the first time I did a show out in BC or did a series of shows in BC, the audience was primarily made up of people from the Maritimes with a connection to the Maritimes. So I went there kind of planning to kind of do all material that was not about here, and then quite quickly realized that the first time I mentioned, for example, I said, like, you know, I mentioned Sussex, and I started to kind of say Sussex is a town with a population of, and everyone like roared, and I'm like, okay,
they're all from Sussex.
here we go. And that has kind of grown, and then as a result more people have come. So that's how I've kind of built a following there. And interestingly, I asked Joel Plaskett a couple of years ago, like, what kind of the secret of his success was, and Plaskett said a very similar thing, where he said that he was lucky enough, or that basically when he first started touring in his late teens, it was around the time of the kind of mass exodus from the Maritimes, and everyone was moving out west, and so he would go out west, and wherever he was performing, say at Fort Mac or wherever it was, everyone who had moved away from here but missed home but had to move away to make serious money or get a job or whatever it was, they were like, oh my god, our guy from Dartmouth is here, we've got to go. Mm-hmm. And they would bring their friends, and that was how he basically built a following across the country. So but I guess to answer your question, so because of that, there are some gigs where I kind of go, okay, I know I'm playing in, for example, Saskatchewan, but this audience is all made up of Maritimers, so I'll give them a bit of everything. I do a lot of obviously corporate gigs across the country, and generally I can either switch the material for it to basically be about. So, for example, any time where you hear me say, you know, on stage, which is a lot, when I'm like, only in the Maritimes or only in New Brunswick would we do this, I can quite easily change it to only in a small town in Canada would we do this. And again, I mean, I have dossiers and dossiers of jokes and stories. And for example, when I go to a place, I would often sit down with a person and go, okay, so So Sussex is like this. What is the equivalent here in Manitoba, or what is the equivalent here? And do it that way. So yeah, it's quite a boring amount of work for something that hopefully ends up being funny.
Yeah. But back to your point of, you know, this is a grind. You're really, you say university level research, yes, of really trying to do your homework in advance of what will connect with the people that you're going to be, you know, entertaining.
That's exactly.
I'm curious, what's your biggest dream for yourself?
To be completely honest, they all happened. And so the biggest, I mean, literally my, and I mean, it was a ridiculous pipe dream. My dream was never to, you know, I've never understood this idea that people have. Like, I get very frustrated when I watch TV talent shows and people come on and they make the final two of American Idol or Canadian Idol or America's Got Talent. And they say, you know, if I don't win, my life is over. And you think, okay, well, you don't actually want to be a singer then. You just want to be famous because your life isn't over. Right. You can be a singer. You can work every single night in a wine bar, on a cruise ship, or in any capacity, you can be a singer. You know, you just want to be famous. Whereas all I ever wanted to do was to perform stand-up. I wanted to write. My love of magazines basically stemmed from the fact that I love living my life as a tourist. I love celebrating other people's work. I love writing about other people's work. So the fact that all of those things that, again, I think I started saying this earlier and I didn't finish it, but I have a diary entry from when I was a teenager saying, you know, what should I pursue? Should I pursue working for a magazine or should I pursue comedy? And I don't think I ever for a second thought that I would be able to do both. And again, no one gave me permission to do both. In fact, the world tells you you can't do both. So the fact that my dream, which was simply to be able to put food on a table and you know, support a family by telling jokes, that ridiculous pipe dream of being able to do that, because of all the millions of people in the world, I'm sure, that think they want to you know, be a comedian or be an entertainer or whatever it is, you know, it's to get there is near impossible. So I know some comedians would answer and say that their dream is to be in an Adam Sandler movie or to be Adam Sandler or to, you know, sell out this size venue. But I mean, literally, I cannot believe that my day-to-day life and my job is doing the thing that I dreamed of doing. So, I mean, to answer the question, my dream, my now also equally ridiculous pipe dream, is to somehow be able to sustain this. And that is the grind that I sit at this very desk doing day in, day out, trying to work so hard to ensure that in 5 years, in 10 years, I can still, you know, put out a quarterly magazine and people will want to buy advertising in it and people will want to subscribe to it, that I can still do shows of a similar size or smaller if it has to be, but just that people will still want to come and see my shows. And as a result, I mean, again, not being in a traditional hub of entertainment where I don't have advisors, I would say my biggest stress in life is trying to figure out ways to maintain it. And I mean, an example of this is, you know, I put so much thought into what to do and more crucially, what not to do. And I would say certainly within the St. John area, I probably turned down upwards of 90% of things that I get offered, because I'm aware of the fact that it's as soon as people or anyone gets sick of someone, then show's over. So, you know, this dawning realization happened to me a few weeks after I played Harbour Station the second time, where I was kind of riding this wave almost of, you know, corporate gigs flying in left, right, and center and saying yes to everything. And I remember walking out on stage at a big fundraiser event at the St. John Training Convention Center, and walked out and saw kind of all the movers and shakers of St. John, and, you know, whether it be the mayor and various other politicians, and all of whom had been in attendance at the show a few weeks before and had been at attendance at other shows I'd done recently. And as I walked out on stage for kind of the, you know, big showtime, here he is, I walk out, I felt this kind of, visibly saw this kind of like, this guy again. And it was that moment I just thought, okay, I need to prevent this. I need to not, you know, so for that reason, and again, I mean, I will support any charity I can in any number of ways. And quite often when a charity approaches me and wants me to be appear at something, I will say, what else can I do? Can I help at the raffle table? Can I volunteer for a day? Can I, whatever I can do, but anything that isn't just that thing of being up and out there. And so that is something. And again, I guess there's a huge, another learning curve is not doing things that aren't the thing that I do. So I used to agree to host a lot of things that weren't, mm-hmm. you know, a food festival, sporting events, music things. And I now realize that it might be the right thing for some people and or indeed some comedians if they want to. But for me, it was a really, really terrible idea. I mean, for example, I now believe that it was a mistake to host the East Coast Music Awards, for instance. It wasn't what I, you know, yes, I can host, but I am, I guess what I mean is I prefer now, and I think the key to longevity is to sticking to doing the thing that I love, which is stand-up comedy and performing for people who are there to see me. So when I get asked to do make an appearance at a large scale sporting event, it's like no one's there to see some stupid English comedian who they may absolutely hate. I don't want to force myself on people that aren't, or be at something where I'm not the reason that they're there. And so, you know, it's like one big show a year, you know, play the Imperial Theatre once a year, write what I hope will be an amazing show and put all my work into it and wow and impress those people that have been kind enough to come. And that, I would say, is the dream is sustaining this. So all of that thought is something that is literally top of mind with me all of the time. And it's funny because you don't want to not get back to people. So I would say the thing that I probably spend the most time doing in every single day is politely declining things that aren't the thing that I have to do. Exactly.
What has been your biggest life lesson so far, do you think?
Excellent question. And I don't want to repeat myself, but I guess reiterating kind of what I said about, I think it's knowing what not to do is certainly as important as what to do. But I think the biggest life lesson really has been, you know, learning, seeing that thing through our children's eyes of, you know, I mean, we have all been told a million times, and again, I mean, I learned so much from your book, but didn't necessarily put all of those messages and ideas into action because I maybe felt like I couldn't, or my brain was not allowing me to. But really trying to enjoy moments and which is such a great thing for this. In this line of work, because I think it has definitely helped me with nerves. I mean, I traditionally would, I think pre a year or two ago, you know, I would wake up a Monday morning, I would look at my diary for the week, and I would be nervous, for example, about this conversation. I would be overthinking what I was going to say, and instead, mm-hmm. I came into it. You know, and you and I didn't pre-plan. You obviously had questions, but you didn't tell me what you were going to ask me. And now I just come into it thinking, well, you know, I can come into it authentically, answer the questions honestly. I'm talking to a friend. I'm talking to also someone who I admire and I respect. What is there to be nervous about? And similarly, I think that's how I look at my week. I used to start a week and I would start off by panicking. Oh my goodness. For example, I have a virtual gig tomorrow. I have a few interviews tomorrow. I have a gig in Miramichi on Saturday. Oh my God. But the last five shows I did in Miramichi went really well. So this one's going to be a disaster. Everyone's going to hate me, blah, blah, blah. Like, rather than think like that.
Yes. All the inner chatter.
Exactly. All the inner chatter. I'm trying to kind of silence that inner chatter. And to that point, you know, and a point that you've made to me before about, you know, in enjoying the journey. And I would say that is the life lesson that I feel like. And I guess to quote Nancy Reagan, it's all about showing up, right? And that very much is it. And just, you know, surrounding yourself with, I mean, blocking out the negativity. And by the negativity, I don't mean ignoring the problems in the world and not helping them. But definitely, I think we all are guilty of, and we're all guilty of this, where, you know, we don't always appreciate the people who are lovely to us, but we focus on the people that aren't. And performers are kind of, you know, and anyone in any kind of artistic field is terrible for, you know, you can get 100 great reviews, and but then someone says something mean on Twitter and that's the only thing you can think
that's
of.
It.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah, and I think certainly one of the things I realized writing the book is that, you know, anyone that is saying negative things about anyone else, other than obviously valid reasons, i.e. if you're talking about Trump or certain, you know, people in the American Senate, but if you're just being mean about someone else's work for no reason, I mean, that says more about, you know, or whatever's the reasons for that are not the target. And so those are kind of life lessons that I think have improved my life immeasurably. And yeah, blocking out that noise and focusing on, you know, important things in the world.
I know you have to go shortly, but last couple of questions. What do you tell your children about living their dreams? What encouragement do you give them?
That is another excellent one. I mean, I certainly, I'm probably like a lot of parents, you know, constantly obviously saying to them, you know, that they can, you know, do anything. But I think, I think I really do, in my conversations with them, literally focus more on just happiness. And it's really never, you know, I mean, I have one son, my youngest son, River, is desperate to be a police officer, which I just think is the most wonderful thing, especially, you know, living where we live, where, you know, I mean, our local police who are, you know, of course, there's, you know, controversy about the police in the world, but where we live, all I know from my friendships with police officers in our region is, you know, their commitment to stamping out domestic violence, their commitments to their community. So I hear this and I just think, well, what an amazing thing that his, whatever he does end up doing in life, if that ends up being it, amazing. But the fact that at eight, the thing he wants to do is to help people. And again, he doesn't want this because of car chases. He wants it because he knows, he looks up to the police in our community as the heroes that they are. And so, yeah, that to me is a beautiful thing. And and again, my other son is obsessed with airplanes and I think would love to be a pilot or in some capacity work with airplanes. But really, I mean, I think the thing that I focus on so much is happiness and really, because of the fact that I wasn't overly happy as a child, I think to me that's just always the most important thing, and that's the thing that I'm constantly kind of pushing them for. The dream in life is to be happy and enjoy what you're doing.
That's yeah, I love that. Happiness, it is so important to be at peace and joy. Yeah. One of the themes that you had running through your book, I felt, was really about the sense of belonging. Do you finally feel like you belong?
I do. I think I do. I mean, there's certainly days that I don't, and there's plenty of, you know, I mean, the voices in my head are still there. I still wake up at, you know, I have 4:48 psychosis, famously coined by the amazing Sarah Kane Baby. I woke up at 4:48 in the morning, and when the brain is at its lowest ebb, and I have the voices in my head telling me, reminding me of every terrible gig I've ever had, and reminding me of every embarrassing and awful thing I've ever done. I still have all of that, but I definitely feel like, I mean, there's nowhere else in the world, you know, but like the Maritimes. And I, you know, as Tony Soprano tried to convince someone in the Sopranos when he didn't want to support, it was a slain mobster, I think, that he had slain. And he used the excuse that there isn't a geographical solution to an emotional problem. Well, I believe there is a geographical solution to an emotional problem if you move to the Maritimes. And I guess, and not wanting to kind of be twee about mental health, I think, and the reason I say that is because despite the fact that we do suffer in this province for, you know, lack of resources for that, and that is a government issue and blame, I think that the secret weapon here, as with everything, is the people and people who care. And I think that's the thing, to move from a city where, regardless of how successful you can be, in a place like London, it is this anonymous throng where, you know, people don't look out for you. I mean, you see, you know, you could see someone collapse in the streets and people just walk around them. You know, but to move to a place where everyone is looking out for you, or, you know, most people are looking out for you, most people are rooting for you, to live in a place like this. And I one of the things that I've really realized writing the book is that I feel so lucky to have met my wife, obviously, for the fact that, you know, obviously fell in love with her, and we have a wonderful family together, an amazing life. And it's the strangest thing to be able to work with your partner all day, every day, and still not want to hate each other at the end of the day. It's a rare thing. And again, I mean, I both obviously love her and also admire her professionally and look up to her as a boss. I mean, she's my boss. I mean, on the paper, when we formed Edit Media, I had to sell my comedy business to her for $1. she is the president. And of course, in the lawyer's office, as I signed this contract and sold my comedy business to her for $1, she of course jokes that it was overpriced. on paper, she's my boss. But I guess to get to the point, all of those things are true, but I also feel incredibly blessed because as well as having an amazing wife and business partner and boss and a mother of my children, if it wasn't for her, I would possibly never have ever heard the words New Brunswick in my entire life. It's possible. And so really for that alone, I'm eternally grateful. So I would say that even if I really didn't like her, I would probably still be with her just because I love living in this place. But luckily I do.
Oh, that's funny. Well, I thank you for your time today. It's a wonderful conversation, as I knew it would be. I mean, you're one of the hardest working people I know. You're a dad, comedian, friend, ambassador, New Brunswicker, and finally Canadian. How will you spend your first Canada Day as an actual Canadian?
That's a good question. Where else but on stage at a theatre in Miramichi performing my new tour show, Becoming Canadian, and of course, No Rest for the Wicked. I pack as much in as possible on every trip, so I arrive in Miramichi. Actually, I say this is obviously Canada Day is Friday, this is Saturday, so Canada Day weekend. Canada Day, it's a good question. I will be at home celebrating, waving flags around, drinking a Moose Light and enjoying myself. But then Canada Day weekend, Saturday the 2nd of July, driving to Miramichi with our mutual friend Tyler Warren Ellis, a videographer and photographer and filmmaker, and we will be doing, I'll be doing a book signing at Coffee Cove, at Mill Cove Coffee in Miramichi in the afternoon, and then doing a show that night. So yeah, I mean, again, none of that feels like work. That to me is the perfect way to spend Canada Day weekend as a Canadian, signing books, meeting Miramichiers, and then performing for them. Happy days.
Yeah, happy days indeed. Miramichi is my hometown, so I know they'll embrace you and love you and give you an amazing first Canada Day weekend. So I know you have to go. You're a busy guy. I really appreciate your time. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Likewise, Dana. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. It's a genuine honor, and I do mean that. And this has been so much fun. Thank you. I can't wait to see you in person soon.
Yes, me too. I'm sure we'll see each other this summer at a show somewhere. Thank you. That was such a great conversation. If you loved it too, subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Please go to iTunes to rate and review this podcast. And if you want to continue the conversation, connect with Soul Sister Conversations on the Facebook and Instagram pages. You can also find me on Instagram and Facebook at Dana Lloyd Leadership, on Twitter at Coach Dana_Lloyd, and of course on LinkedIn. See you next week.